Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Welcome to another Word in Your Ear. Now, we like to think that we help provide a little light entertainment in lockdown, but one of the runaway success stories during the dark days and still going from strength to strength was, of course, Tim's Twitter Listening Party, now available in book form. And it was started by the great Tim Burgess. Tim, lovely to see you. And how are you? Or where are you, in fact? It's a hotel room, isn't it?
In a hotel, yeah. I'm in a place called the Stafford in London, which is very nice. And so I'm happy to be here. So, yeah, sadly no records surrounding me, though, like you guys. But
Dave's aren't real. I'm afraid we always say this.
Yeah, it's just mine's green screen.
Yeah, it's wallpaper. It's wallpaper. But look, for the benefit of anybody watching and listening who doesn't know about the listening party, explain when you started it and how you started it and how it works.
Okay, well, I mean, the very, very, very early days, you know, maybe about 8 years ago, I was watching Four Lions, the film Four Lions, and by Chris Morris, and Riz Ahmed said that he tweeted the next scene where I get in the car. Chris used the shot where I laughed the least, and I thought, flipping heck, that's amazing. If I did this with a record, it'd be brilliant. So
it was broadcast on TV. It was on TV at the time, and he just tweeted at the time it was on TV.
Tweeted at the time it was on TV, and I just thought, wow, I'm going to see if I can do that with the record. And I asked my Twitter followers, and at that time I had about 6,000 followers because I just started out. I didn't know what to do with Twitter. And I said, I'm going to do some friendly, a tweet along with some friendly. Does anyone think it's a good idea? And loads did, and they listened along. You know, I put the album on. And tweeted through it. And, you know, there's great moments where it's just like, oh, baseline. And, you know, just tweeted that and, you know, tagged, you know, track three or whatever. And I did that. And I did it lots of times over the past 8 to 10 years. But on the week leading up to the first lockdown, I mentioned that I'd do our first album again. And Alex from Franz Ferdinand said, oh, I love that record. I bought it when I was 17. At that moment, I thought, well, why don't you do one? And, you know, you can use my followers and we can guide it towards Franz Ferdinand fans and we can all have a good time.
So you just announced, don't you, which album you're going to discuss, and you tell people precisely what point at time to start playing it. So everybody is listening simultaneously to the record. Yeah. And you get those comments at precisely the moment that they're discussing in the track, which is really thrilling, actually, hearing those little details, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, I mean, I use the clock on my computer, you know, and that's when I press play. And, you know, even if there's a little bit of a lapse, you know, it doesn't really matter. You know, if people are a bit late, if they're listening in Colorado, you know, it doesn't really matter anyway, you know, as long as it's kind of almost at the same time.
And but as regards lockdown, it obviously really was very, very thrilling for people, a lot of them in isolation, to think that they were all doing something commonly in real time at the same time.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, to have their headphones on, it was like we were all in isolation, but people felt isolated, you know, even with themselves in that, you know. So for them to have some of their favorite records with members, significant members, or people who did the artwork, or the producer tweeting along their memories, and saying, oh, this is a moment where Graham Coxon fell off his chair or whatever, when he was like laughing so hard, or, you know, and things that we would never know, and probably they wouldn't have admitted when the album actually came out, because, you know, when you put an album out, you're super cool, aren't you? And you just want, you only want.
That's a very good point.
10 years later, no one cares, you know, so it's.
Yeah.
Because that's what Mark and I always used to complain about, is when you interview an artist about their new album, it's always the best record they've ever made.
Exactly.
And then 2 months later, it's totally forgotten about or something. They've forgotten about it.
And they're plugging the back catalogue furiously. And who can blame them? But you've had... which have been the particular... you've had some amazing success stories. I mean, you had McCartney. Was he hard to get? I mean, that was fantastic.
Well, you know, I built up my confidence of asking people, because I'd asked lots of people that I wanted, but then lots of people were asking me, and there was, you know, surprise people asking, surprises asking me, and I can't think right now because I'm talking too fast, but so I was confident enough when I saw that McCartney had advertised that McCartney 3 was coming out to just tweet to him and say, how about a listening party? And of course, most people respond immediately, and obviously there was nothing. and until 6 weeks later, where I got an emoji thumb up.
And that's what thumb up.
It's so McCartney, but it's a thumbs up.
That's the official McCartney communication.
And it's a thumbs aloft.
And from that moment, it became, you know, about a week, 8 days of frantic phone calls, multiple Zoom calls, and a signed record, you know, sent through the post. So it was an amazing thing. He, you know, took part in it. He really enjoyed it. He said some beautiful things about me, and I'll never forget it. So
right, very good.
You know, Iron Maiden, which was insane. It was trending at number one within about, I don't know, 1 minute 45 of their first song, they were number one trending on Twitter.
Well, the heavy metal community is a massively solid brotherhood, isn't it, and sisterhood?
It really is, and we have a replay element to the listening party on the website that, and within 24 hours they were number one by, I don't know. The second one was half of what they had, so, and then, you know, I think, and then within 48 hours they were bigger than the whole of the top 10 put together.
Wow. And is that presumably international?
Yeah it is. I mean, especially when Iron Maiden are involved.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. I mean, have you noticed, you presumably noticed this spreading from country to country, have you, generally?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is international. I mean, it started off humbly, in a way, by people that I knew, you know, Bonehead and Dave Rowntree and Wendy Smith.
Alex Kapranos, I think, was one of the early ones. Yeah.
And then it just kind of, you know, it just became open to everybody, really. I wanted to make it, you know, a solid thing as it could be. I imagined like running a magazine, but you'll tell me probably otherwise. You know, to kind of like, you know, build it up, so it's like really, you know, made to be really strong. And then all of a sudden, I just let everybody get involved, and then asked people that I wanted. So it was kind of, it was a group effort, really. I feel, you know, when Kylie came in, and I was on my way to Rockfield to do some recordings, and I had to pull over for like 4 hours just to sort out, sort out Kylie Minogue's listening party. That, you know, they gave me a couple of days notice. But, you know, you have to do those kind of things, you know, when it's a big artist like that.
So you had Kylie, you had members of the Smiths and Go-Go's, New Order, Culture Club, Tears for Fears. I mean, were there any that were particular favourites that you thought were just, you were really pleased with?
So I got a phone call from Ian Astbury, Roisin Murphy, and Gary Kemp all on the same day, to talk about their listening parties. And Roisin has been like, she's been, you know, a runaway success out of the whole lot of them. She's been amazing and very entertaining. Dance videos all the way throughout. Incredible. But Gary Kemp, I never really knew much about Spandau Ballet. I didn't know anything about them. I was listening to different music at that point. You know, I was listening to New Order. You know, they were my thing. So, but when I read his stories and was listening to True, the album, it just blew my mind. You know, it was really amazing. I didn't know that their artwork was done. You know, I'm a big fan of Aztec Camera, and I saw their artwork together, and someone pointed out that it was the same guy who did it, and I was like, oh my God, so similar, but like such worlds apart for me when I was like growing up. You know, Aztec Camera were my thing and Spandau Ballet weren't, but I love Spandau Ballet now. I'm not going to say their name again. And Gary is just an amazing.
He's an amazing talker, isn't he?
Yeah.
But there's something really exciting about, there's a bit in the, you mentioned the New Order one, there's a bit in the New Order one where Stephen Morris says that the drums on Age of Consent were cut and pasted from a Joy Division track. I mean, that, I love things like that. You know, there's just, it's just because you then listen to that record differently. There was a bit, I think it's Simon Le Bon, I've written it down here, and he said, I don't know which Duran Duran track it was, he said, it all begins with a blow to the naked strings of the Steinway Grand in Ayers Studio One, played backwards. And if memory serves me, it was Nick dropping one of his pixie boots from a considerable height that worked best. And that's a fantastic detail, isn't it?
It really is, you know.
Every time you would hear that track, you would just think of how they made that sound. And it's just amazing.
And Simon joining in on Hookie's Joy Division listening party as well, and saying that he was at a gig, you know, an early Joy Division gig, which you would never have known, but Simon made it a point that he would let the world know that he was at a Joy Division gig. And and Stephen as well, Gillian popped in for Technique and said, I wrote this song when everyone was at the pub, or, you know, and it was Dream Attack, my favourite song, I think, on Technique, but, you know, arguably my favourite song. I argue with myself. Just to know that, because, you know, you as a fan, they all credit each, you know, it's split four ways, you know, the credits. So you never know who wrote what, but it's just the information like that was priceless, really.
It is. And there was one year with Kevin Rowland, which was quite touching, really, where he sort of, it seemed to revive his own interest in his own music. You know, he'd being made to go back and listen to it again in that detail. Really kind of, really, he felt was sort of really inspiring.
Yeah, I mean, all lineups of all the three big Dexys, well, I guess there's four, but, you know, the 80s ones, late 70s and 80s ones. They all joined in, so there's nine for Young Soul Rebels, there's nine for 2RIA, and you know, everyone joined in for Don't Stand Me Down as well. And Kevin really reconnected with and mentioned in the Big Issue that he wasn't that keen on doing a listening party until he was convinced to do it. And once he did, he's like reconnected with both of his albums so much. You know, for 40 years he'd never been able to listen to Young Soul Rebels.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's kind of, it's people relaxing about things that's caused them tension over the years, isn't it?
Yeah. It's pretty, I mean, with Kevin, you know, I mean, you know just how serious he is, you know. I mean, so it was such a huge compliment for him to say that the listening party got him to appreciate his first album again. He always thought it was too tinny.
Yeah. Is there an advantage too about doing it via Twitter? Like, it just struck me that, you know, if you're in a room with somebody and you're talking to them in person, they can be much more self-conscious and much more guarded, and they're thinking of the audience watching them or whatever. But if they're just tweeting, do you think you get more kind of off the cuff, more honest responses sometimes
from the audience? You mean
the artists,
the musicians?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they think about it quite a lot before they do a party. And, you know, I love Stevens. He's just so funny, and he brings out photographs that have never been seen, and he always talks about Rob, and he always talks about Tony Wilson, and, you know, brings everybody in. You know, I know that they've had quite a few arguments, New Order, over the past, you know, few years, but he's always very cool about Hookie's, you know, involvement, and you know, he talks about them as if they're still together that way, and it's just a beautiful thing. And on a Joy Division one, Stephen joined in with Hookie doing it, and it was like they might have arguments outside the band, but when it comes,
yes, that might not have been possible in the same room.
Yeah, and yes, there you go. There you go.
So you say you approach McCartney via Twitter. Is that generally the way you do it? Or do you go through managers and PRs and so forth?
No, it gets really complicated. I do everything through DMs. Right. I've approached people on Twitter, and I have approached occasionally on email. But it comes through instant messenger, Instagram, Facebook. You know, it's complicated enough to keep track of it, where it's all coming from. I much prefer it if people just DM me, you know.
Yeah, no, sure.
And you've got a kind of a hub now, haven't you? So you can go back and listen to any one of those records, and you just, yeah, it tells you when to start playing the record, and then you just watch those tweets appear, yeah, as they did in, yeah, real time.
Yeah, yeah. Action replay.
Can you measure the number of people who are going back and looking at that? I mean, can you calibrate what scale the whole thing is on? We probably can't tell how many people around the world are involved.
Well, so, you know, like I was saying, that Iron Maiden, there are figures, and I think it was like 70,000 for Iron Maiden.
That's huge.
That was within 48 hours of their listening party on the replay, and the one below that I think was John was McCartney, and that was 40,000, and then Liam was like 20, and then I think John Lennon was, you know, 19 or something, like, you know, and it's,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
But there's, you know, 1.5 million I think replays at the moment.
It's fantastic, and it's limitless. I mean, presumably you're going to keep going. Why stop? I mean, this is just a
stop. Yeah, I mean, I it got ridiculous during the lockdown. You know, but the lockdown was ridiculous anyway.
It was several a day, wasn't it?
Yeah, I did ten in one day, and that was for Sea Change Festival, Breeders Headline, Midlake, who else? Yeah, Breeders, Midlake. John Grant, I DJ'd, you know, whatever that means.
Yeah.
There was so much fun, and the Broken Record, you know, that was the whole Spotify crew. Boy George headlined that, and I can't remember now. But this.
So you've enjoyed it. You haven't thought at any stage, oh, I've made a bit of a rod for my own back here.
Well, of course. I don't know what rod for your own back means so much, but I mean, of course, it's been a lot of work. You know, at the beginning, it was 10 hours a day, but lots of that was just organizing and people, you know, and emails coming in, me responding, giving them a date, them saying, I can't do that date, and me saying,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, lots of other things coming in and having post-it stickers and just being, you know, being a shambles at getting my dates wrong and all that kind of stuff, and offering three bands the same time slot, and you know, it just got to me a little bit, but it got the more I did it, the easier it became. And you know, I actually did a listening party at the bus stop, so that was, instead of sitting in front of my computer, I thought that was a big game changer for me. No, I could actually do it quite casually, and now I just, you know, it's, you know, I'm pretty on top of it now. It's okay. Just look on my phone. Just do it. Listen.
And there's a book. There's a kind of book version which has kind of highlights of 100 of the parties. You know, and I think in the grand tradition of our podcast, we ought to ask you about some of the records that you really liked when you were a kid. Can you remember the first records you bought?
Yeah, I mean, I was the first record I remember buying was The Great Rock and Roll Swindle. And, you know, I went on holiday with my mum and dad. They gave me £10 and I didn't spend a penny. And when I got back, I went to the local record shop and bought it for about, I think it was $6.99. Buzzcocks, my nan bought me that. So that was the first sort of 11, 12 years old, you know, kind of. And then I liked the, you know, the Jam, and then lots of post-punk, Madonna, then Crass and Flux Pink Indians, and you know, Subhumans and bands like that. They were the first kind of bands that I went to see.
Yeah, what was the first gig you ever saw?
It was Crass at a Scout Hall in Winsford.
My God, Crass.
A Scout Hall.
And a Scout Hall. That's in the deep end, isn't it, Dave? So, jeez, that must have taken some courage. How old were you?
13.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Were you in the Scouts? Did you read the music press?
Yeah, everything. Just devoured it.
What did you read?
Well, Sounds, Melody Maker and Enemy. I read True, you know, when that first came, Paul McCartney on the front cover, the first edition.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, really?
Excellent. Wow. The launch issue.
Big news, you know.
It was.
My mum used to work in a news agent, so she used to keep everything back for me.
Oh, very good. Which news agent did she work in? Was it a big one or a local one? Or?
It was, it's not even, well, you know, obviously hardly any are there anymore, but.
No, sure.
It was, I grew up in a village called Moulton, M-O-U-L-T-O-N, and it's a postcode Northwich. And
all right.
Yeah, and so very small village, yeah. Kind of thing, and you know.
Can you remember where did you buy records? Was there a shop there?
It's Northwich Underground Market in Northwich, and you know, go to Manchester. And go to the market in Manchester as well and buy punk clothes and 7 inches, 7 inch singles. I used to like, you know, second generation punk, GBH, Discharge, anything with a kind of like, you know, terrible name for the teenage mind. and then you
would horrify your parents.
Yeah, exactly. And then New Order, age 16, changed everything around, really. I loved Aztec Camera, loved the program, The Tube. You know, right. Picked up records, recommendations from that. Used to go to the Hacienda, big on anything from Manchester, really.
Right.
Tony Wilson's fault, you know. And then I started to love Californian music and music from New York and music and Berlin, you know, but again, Berlin because of Tube, I think, you know.
Yeah, they promoted a lot of that stuff, didn't they?
They did, yeah. And it was really interesting, you know, for me, between like 16 and 21, I imagine, you know, it was the big thing.
So, are you apart from your listening parties? What else are you doing? You're about to tour, are you?
Yeah, Charlatans are doing a 30th anniversary tour. I've just got back. Yesterday was my last day of my solo tour for a record I put out. You know, in May 2020.
What does it feel like to be back on stage again? Because I imagine that some of the listening party was filling that vacuum of wanting to be able to kind of get out and perform.
It was.
I mean, it's kind of therapy for you in the same way as I think doing this. David always says therapy for us doing our podcast and for the people listening and watching. Just everybody's in it together, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it helped me as much as it helped everybody else. You know, people have said some amazingly nice things about the listening party and what it meant to them during lockdown and things, but it really helped me too. I was supposed to, you know, before the album came out in March, you know, I was supposed to go to South by Southwest and that got cancelled, but we were in New York doing some warm-up shows. So I'd started the whole process of promoting my new record that was about to come out in May, and it got pulled. When I got back, you know, I just thought, wow, what's, you know, I thought it was going to be 3 weeks that the, you know, for a lockdown. So I did some listening parties, planned 3 weeks and thought that'd be it. And then it just, everything just kept going and they got big and touring seemed like a thing of, from the distant past or something like that. And I just kind of, I don't know. I didn't know what to think really, but it feels great being on stage now. And obviously it feels the same, but I didn't think it would, but it did, and I've enjoyed it even more so because of the time not doing it. You know, it's the first time in 30 years that I've not been playing a record live.
Yeah. But you've been doing this instead.
Very important work, and it's fantastic how much attention it's got, and how many people have been really knocked out with just how it's helped them get through the bad times, etc. For that, you should be massively congratulated. So, Dave, we normally end, don't we, with the greatest record of all time?
Yes.
Well, should we do that? Could you nominate what you think is the greatest record of all time? We put you on the spot there.
God, I mean, I've just got like a huge blank. let me just go through.
Give us five possibilities.
Well, I mean, I do love, I know this is like slow, but I don't want to say Beach Boys' Pet Sounds, but there's not really no other way around it.
Okay, that's fair enough.
Absolutely brilliant, yeah.
It's a brilliant one. Five, I like Iggy Pop. Which one though? It could be any. It could be any. You know, Stooges, the first Stooges record with 1969 on it.
Right.
I love that one. Vashti Bunyan, her record.
The original one?
Diamond Day. Yeah, that's really gorgeous.
That's an interesting choice. Wow.
Judy Sill, you know.
Judy Sill. Oh, God, yes. But the Vashti Bunyan, it's one of those tragic things where it took her so long, didn't it, to go up to Donovan's commune. Didn't she go by horse-drawn caravan or something?
Yeah, from London.
And took her 18 months to get there. And there's a brilliant moment when she arrives at the commune, and I think the day before they've all left. And one of the locals says, oh, you should have been here yesterday, all these amazing people here, but they've all just packed up and gone home. And then she went off and made the record. And by then she kind of missed her moment, I think. It all just gone.
I took her to a festival. Within a festival called Peaks, and it happens at Kendall Calling. I asked Vashti if she'd come, and I knew she wasn't going to play live, but I asked her to come and talk to me. And so I did a nice interview with her. And at the end, the crowd just started saying, sing a song. And she was like, no. And she's like the shyest person. And in the end, she just did this a cappella song of Timothy Grubb, pretty sure the song was called, and it was just like the most amazing thing. You could hear a pin drop, and she was overwhelmed that she actually done it, you know.
I was at her comeback show. I think it was the first time she played for, I mean, really, what, 30 odd years, wasn't it? She did this. Were you there, I wonder, at the Barbican?
No, it was
extraordinary. I have never seen anybody so nervous in my life. It was very hard to relax. She was so wound up about it.
Yeah.
And what a story. She's phenomenal.
Story. She tells it so sweetly as well, that they would, you know, pull over and just pick vegetables. But it was a horse and cart, you know. It's like...
That's just right.
And, but yeah, Judy Sill, the one with Loping Around the Cosmos, that's a beauty. I love Ram. You know, I absolutely love Ram. Listen to that any time of day.
Ram?
Yeah.
Yeah,
Michael. Masterpiece.
Yeah, it's a masterpiece. And I love the way it's recorded.
Monkbury Moon Delight. Yeah. Incredible.
Amazing. That's the one. That's the one, yeah. Yeah. They're all good, but that's just amazing. I could happily say that Ram was my favourite album of all time.
That's fair enough.
I think that's completely fair enough. You never get tired of it.
Don't.
So many extraordinary tunes. It's absolutely genius.
Yeah.
Well, what fun. It's been really lovely to talk to you.
You too.
And we will enthusiastically, vigorously plug the book and your tour and all your great works. Thanks so much for talking to us.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Hold up. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.